This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and in this episode, part two of my chat in a noisy London pub with Magnus Walker. Self-made man, in his 20s he left Sheffield in the north of England and he moved to the USA, where he made his fortune, firstly as a clothing designer, and these days he's in the movie location business.
You do what you love, right? And I don't think that can be taught. It can be copied and emulated, but then you're following that train, right?
More from Magnus soon. Right now, let's have a look at what's been going on. Well, across the channel in France, they've increased the penalties for wolf whistling in public. You're not happy about this, Scott.
Now I represent a movement called MFB, and that is Men Fight Back. Okay.
Okay,
well,
Scott,
if you're a man, if you're a man in a position of power, you really need to stick up for your own sex.
Okay.
If you would, please.
Okay.
We're relying on people like you in the public eye. Now, I'm after something called equality.
Right.
And that's right across the board.
Yeah.
And a lot of women nowadays, I mean, back in the 90s, it's not a new thing. Women started going to watch dance troupes, all-male dance troupes called the Dream Boys.
Yeah.
Stuff like this.
And others,
Yeah. Now, you get just as many women, ravenous women, that will lech quite openly, and they get away with it because society deems it acceptable, over young guys in pubs and laughing at men's demise. Men are portrayed as buffoons on adverts and in television and in life in general. And this is where I believe quite strongly that the balance needs to be redressed. And if you want equality, girls, then you're going to have to meet us in the middle, because if you don't, guess what? We're going to be in a demographic winter. The population's going to go down. We're not going to want you. You're going to get the weak guys, the guys that you can control, but this is what they want anyway. They want the guys that are going to give them all the resources and all the money, which is what it's all about.
So, Scott, you're saying that the women are, there's a campaign to actually degrade men and devalue them so that the women can have more power. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I should think that if any man hasn't noticed it, then he's had his head in the sand like an ostrich for the last few years.
So when people use the phrases like man flu, that's degrading to men?
Well,
is that all part of it?
Us being guys, we don't take exception of any silly little thing like man flu or anything like that.
Yeah.
We haven't got our head in a cloud. We're not trying to make a point.
Well, we wouldn't get away with describing something as woman flu, would we? That would be deemed as sexist. But man flu seems acceptable.
The word sexism seems to only exist when it benefits a woman.
Okay.
It's a shovel for her to dig with, basically. When you go to a bar in a pub, or you go to a restaurant in any place up and down the country, or indeed in the Western culture, you will see men paying 90% of the bills.
Mm-hmm.
That is a fact. I used to work in a restaurant and I saw it all the time. Now, if they want equality, then I'm all for it. I only accept a woman that is my peer and my equal. If she's not, she can hit the highway.
Okay.
Now, this is not a new thing.
Okay, well, we're running out of time here, Scott, but wolf whistling then, should it be allowed or not? Because in France, they're going to fine people for wolf whistling, fine men, I'm guessing, for wolf whistling.
Well, as I've said, it goes on with women too. Women, you know, they do it as much as men. If they want to be pseudo men, then they're going to have to tough up and they're going to have to be like us. If they don't like it, then they just have to swallow it, won't they? Because the nature of a man is to notice a palatable woman. Now, secretly, if they're honest, I believe they actually like it. They want to be lusted after. They spend 45 minutes in front of the mirror every morning.
Scotland has just brought in a silly law. You can't buy cheap booze north of the border anymore. It's because of new minimum pricing regulation. The cost of drinks now depends on how many units of alcohol they have. A 2-litre bottle of cider that was £2.50 now costs at least £7.50. The Scottish Government says it'll cut consumption and save lives. That's because the Scottish Government are idiots. This new law won't affect rich people. They'll just pay the extra. The law is aimed at stopping poor people from drinking too much. And it won't work. Because alcoholics are addicts. If you have an addiction, the true cost is everything you have. You can end up losing your income, your home, your partner, your friends, your family, even your life. The price of addiction couldn't be any higher. And still, addicts continue to use. Do you really think putting an extra fiver on a bottle of Diamond White will make any difference? This law will reduce the time it takes for problem drinkers to get to the point where they can't pay their bills. Addicts turn to crime to feed their habit. It'll start with shoplifting at places that sell booze and could lead to more serious offences. The extra money from the higher prices goes to the retailers, because this is not a tax. None of the extra revenue will go to organisations that can actually help people with a drink problem. It'll make things a lot worse for people whose lives are ruined because they spend too much on booze. How did the Scots come up with such a dumb idea? Had they been drinking? Mick's on the phone. Mick, I spoke to a bloke called Scott, and he reckons that men are being degraded by women. What do you think?
Yeah, it's the same as a blonde bimbo, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's wrong, isn't it? To you know, you can't really tell blonde jokes anymore. Like, if I was to tell you this joke, it would be politically incorrect. If I was to say to you, what have blondes and cowpats got in common?
Got him.
The older they get, the easier they are to pick up. That is a sexist joke. I'm not allowed to use that kind of humour because it degrades blonde women. Is wolf whistling offensive, Lisa?
You know what? I would be lying if I said, and I think a lot of women share this view, I would love to be wolf whistled. Why not?
Right.
Put a little string in my step. And actually, if I'm totally honest with you, I've been known to give a few wolf whistles out myself when I'm out with the girls, you know?
Right then.
Any gorgeous builders or whatever, and I would find it a huge compliment if somebody was to wolf whistle me. I'd smile, I'd say thank you very much.
All right, Lisa, thank you very much.
Goodbye, Graham. I wolf whistle here as well.
Okay, there we go. Wolf whistling, blonde jokes, are they wrong? Joe?
My place, my predominant workforce is women.
Right.
Overwhelming majority of them happen to be blonde.
Right.
And they don't mind having a bit of banter about the blonde thing, and I quite often get, as an excuse for, you know, something went wrong, sorry Joe, having a blonde moment, and then there's a general chuckle. So I would say, really, let's let women decide what they want instead of blokes telling them for them.
Okay. And have you noticed, as being in the minority there, that the ladies treat you as if you're a bit daft?
I tell you what I do find. Women don't mind being a little bit rude.
Okay.
quite often a bit of, the opposite.
So you're saying in your working environment, you've got equality, or as near to it, with equality with respect to each gender? Yeah.
I'd like to think so, yeah. There's no specific reason why I have a predominantly female workforce, other than the fact that they were the people best for the job, and that's who we employed.
All right, good to talk to you, Joe. Thanks a lot, mate.
All right, buddy.
What about wolf whistling? Was it allowed in your workplace?
Well, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't mind getting a wolf whistle, but I'm figuring I'm probably not the right shape for it these days.
So it would be quite the compliment.
Yeah, for me.
All right, thanks a lot. Cheers, Joe. What do you reckon about this then, Sam?
I reckon it's a load of tish.
Right.
Sorry, I know that sounds really quite blunt, but it is. I mean, wolf whistling has been around for years and years and years. Nobody's ever complained before now. And it's a few, it's like a minuscule amount of people that don't like it. You get wolf whistled at, whether you're male or female, and in general, it's quite appreciated. You know, if you get wolf whistled, there must be something right with you.
So do you think this law is being brought in by people who've never been wolf whistled then?
I don't know. I mean, you get some people that just want to complain about everything.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, I mean, if somebody wolf whistled me now, it'd be the first time in about 25 years and I'd be over the moon.
An elderly couple who forgot where they'd parked their car have been reunited with it 5 days later. Emmanuel Elliott, who's 81, and his partner Hilda Farmer, who's 79, they left it somewhere near Cheltenham General Hospital, but couldn't remember where. They left it on the Friday. It was found the following Tuesday, about 900 metres from the hospital. It had been ticketed 3 times by wardens. When have you done this? Lynn?
I took my mother to a hospital I'd not been to before. We parked the car, I took her in, she had her appointment, came back again, and I thought, oh no, the car's been stolen.
Oh, right. Oh, you didn't think, oh no, I can't remember where I've parked it.
No,
you went to where you thought it was and it wasn't there.
Searched the whole car park, couldn't find it. I went to the parking attendant, I said, I think my car's been stolen. And he said, are you absolutely certain? He said, it was this car park. He said, there is another car park. I said, where? And he said, just about 500 yards down the road. He said, there's another car park. And I thought it was in there.
Vince, what's your story of when you lost your car?
Stay at the airport.
Yes.
Car park.
Yeah.
Well, you know when you pull into a zone, don't you?
Yeah.
Zone D or something, and then you should take a row number.
Yes.
I'm a man, I know where I park my car.
Are you? No, in those airports, those lot where you're away for a week or 2 weeks and you get the little, you buy the thing and you get the little shuttle bus and whatever, yeah, and they have like green 12 or whatever
that's
it is.
Right, yeah.
And you normally, I write it on the ticket.
Well, you sort of do now. We've been away, we came back.
Yeah.
Got off the coach. There must have been about 10 or 12 of us. Got off. Falling down with rain, which doesn't help.
Yeah.
None of us. We're walking up and down. Couldn't find our cars. Everybody's, you know, you press your button, don't you, to flash your lights.
Yeah, the blipper, yeah, making a blip, yeah.
Everybody's doing this and we're all passing each other. But we just can't find our cars.
Well, how many of you have got this problem?
There's about 10 of us. 10, 12.
And are you all people, were you all travelling together or are you 10 strangers bonded by a common experience of incompetence?
Well, we were quite friends at the end of it.
I'll bet you were, yeah.
And then suddenly we saw somebody's car flashing in the distance.
Right.
So we wandered over there and it turns out that the coach had dropped us at a different pickup point.
Oh, you'd got off at like the wrong bus stop.
And
yeah.
The cars were right over the other side of the car park.
Right. Okay.
So, we must have been sort of 30, 40 minutes walking up and down.
What, and everybody's cars were in the same other area?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been away for the weekend. Yeah.
You'd only been away for the weekend. I can see why you wouldn't have taken that much notice. If you've gone away for a couple of weeks, yeah, but at the weekend, you'd like, well, how different can it be?
I go to Ireland. I go to Ireland a lot, so I think it was in Ireland.
Right.
And, yeah, we just couldn't find, you know what it's like when you find it, you pop at each other, but, we lost it for at least 40 minutes.
Well, I'm glad I had a happy ending.
Well, I'm right on the ticket now.
Right on the ticket, that's it. That's the one, that's the one. Vince, thanks for sharing. Let's get to my guest. It's part two of my chat with Magnus Walker. In his 20s, he moved from the industrial north of England, a town called Sheffield, to the USA. He settled in Los Angeles, where he built up a very successful clothing business, Sirius Clothing, and now he rents out the warehouse where he lives as a movie location. Along the way, he's collected classic Porsche cars. In 2013, he was the subject of a short documentary film, Urban Outlaw, and the legend was born. It's quite a story. We talked about it in a noisy pub in Shoreditch, London, and how his story became a book.
Well, let me tell you how the book came about, because it actually came about right across the road from where we sat at the Ace Hotel. So, before Urban Outlaw came out, I got approached by this guy, Liam, in the Prodigy, the music band. I don't know if you know those guys.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know them, but I know of them. By reputation, I know.
Oh, super, super cool, down-to-earth, genuine people. And Liam had shot me an email, seen the thread, interested in a car, would I build a car for him? So I said, you know what, mate? I don't build customer cars. You know, there's a misconception in a sense that people think I'm an independent tuner specialist building and selling customer cars. That's not what I do. I said to him, with all due respect, that's not what I do, but what car do you like? Because I really like your 68R, the silver car. You know what? If you want it, it's yours. He ended up buying the car for me. A couple of months later, I said, can I borrow it a little bit longer? So I'm making this short film. I'd love to have the car in the film. That became Urban Outlaw. That 68R is the car that Liam owns. And so why is Liam important in this story? Well, his friend Martin Roach is an author who's written over 150 books. Half of them are on music. One of the very first books he did was on the Prodigy years and years ago. And Martin Roach came from this punk rock background, but was a writer and a publisher. So his recent big claim to fame was the number one best-selling boy band in the world, One Direction. He wrote that book. And then on the automotive side, he's written everything from Bugatti to supercar books for boys. And as I always jokingly make fun of him in a certain way, he wrote the Nigel Mansell book, Staying on Track. And nothing against Nigel Mansell, great guy, but I always joke with Martin about, you know, hey, how's Nigel? So he'd just done the book on Nigel Mansell, Staying on Track, which became one of the top 10 books of all time. Sports books in England was on the top 10 list, and I was a follow-up book to that. And how did that story happen? Well, my buddy Liam said, hey, I have a friend who's a writer, thinks he may be a story in your life. He wants to talk to you about writing a book. So 2015, I'm doing this Need for Speed video game here in London, ironically, and we're filming not far away from where we're at, and we're at Shoreditch. And so I said to Liam, sure, I'll meet your buddy Martin. I'm staying at the Ace Hotel. He came over and met me. We got on really, really well, because interesting guy, music, cars, automotive, punk rock sort of knowledge background. So we struck up a conversation and said, hey, yeah, this would be pretty good. You know, I left school at 15 with two O levels, and one of them was not English, and I've read one book in my life, and I've got a lot of books, but I tend to look at pictures. I don't read. So Martin was a ghostwriter, but interestingly, he was on this high of the Mansell book, top 10 sport book of all time. He'd say to his publishers and agents, hey, have you heard of this guy, Magnus Walker? And they go, yeah, we kind of like him, because English guy living in LA, ticks a few bases, right? Rock and roll, English, went to America, did okay, car angle to it too. So long story short, I went home for Christmas that year, and Martin came to visit me in England. Still don't have a book deal, but things are bubbling pretty quick. And I showed him everywhere I'd lived in Sheffield, where I went to school, the three houses I'd lived in, and clicked really, really well. And then we ended up getting a bidding deal between Penguin and Random House over the book. We ended up choosing Penguin Random House. And then the following year, 2016, Martin came out, spent a week with me in LA. Basically told him my story. We just hung out and just turned the phone on and talked, conversated. I showed him around everything in LA, where I'd been when I first got there, the YMCA youth hostel, where I stayed for 5 nights when I first got there, and I told him my whole story. And Martin Roach is a little bit like Tamir. Both those people made me look good.
Because the book speaks with your voice. I didn't even know it was ghostwritten. I mean, I read it, and it's your. I hear your voice.
Well, it's amazing that you say that, because Martin told me his wife said to him, I met his wife later on, I hadn't met her before this. I'd met Martin twice in England. He flew out to LA, spent a week with me in LA. And then he went back home, and just like Tamir, I didn't hear from him for like 3 months. These guys get into their head. And his wife said, because she'd heard all the tapes, she said, you're starting to sound like Magnus. And Martin lives in the Shire, he's from Birmingham.
Wow.
That's not where I'm from.
Wow.
But he got into my head, and that's what's genius about him.
It's
that's
a great...
the genius about Martin Roach,
yeah.
Which is a genius with Tamir.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Without those two people, I wouldn't be here. Those people both make me look good. So here's the killer thing, right? The book comes out June 1st, 2017. So what is that, 9 months ago, right?
Yeah.
So I do a UK book tour. And instead of doing book signings at Waterstones or Barnes & Nobles, we do them at Porsche centres. And I went on tour. I did kicked off at the Ace Cafe, my favourite place. So, first book signing, Ace Cafe, I signed books for 4 hours on a Tuesday. Second one next day, Waterstones book retailer in the city, Leadenhall Market. Completely different crowd. Suit and tie guys from Wall Street types waiting in line outside of Waterstones for 2 hours to buy my book. Third one I did was at East London Porsche Centre. Then I did one at Silverstone, one at Wolverhampton, one in Sheffield and one in Aberdeen. All related to where my family was. Martin was Wolverhampton, close to where he lives in the Shire, and obviously Sheffield hometown for me, homecoming, and my sister lives in Aberdeen. So hey, let's go do a Tartan Outlaw Gallery in Aberdeen, right? Well, within the first week I've done those 5 dates. Second week, the book goes top 10 in the London bestseller list. How does this happen, right? Well, obviously Martin's a spectacular writer, and I guess my story related to people. But back to that Waterstones meeting. The audience that related to the book was everyone from like 10 years old all the way up to 70 years old, from guys like me to city boys wearing suit and ties. Now remember I told you this is the kickoff to my month-long tour. Well, the end of this month-long tour in Europe, I'm doing a German book tour. The book just got picked up and is translated into German. I'm doing a German book tour in 6 German cities, including a big fair in Hamburg, and the book got picked up by this publisher called DK Publishing. Also, the book got picked up and is going to be translated into Japanese, so there'll be a Japanese book tour. Now, none of this would have happened, really, if it wasn't for Liam and Martin getting together and me saying yes more than I say no and saying, hey, why not, right? How bad can this be? You know, what's special about my story? Nothing. But the relatability to it is everyone can relate to that passion and the dream of never giving up. So I think that's a connecting thread that is my relatability to people. You know, I'm authentic. You know, I'm not trying to sell you something. If you're along for the ride, great. If you like what I'm into, great. If not, everyone's got an opinion, right? But I've always sort of surrounded myself with people that know more than I know. I've never been afraid to take risks. I've never been afraid to ask for help. And I've never been afraid to take that challenge of the unknown, i.e. the film, i.e. the book, even though I had no experience in that background. You know, without the film, the TED Talk would never have happened. Without that, the book would never have happened. So it all really goes back to the past 5 years into Tamir's film. Because I don't think I'm any different, but none of that would have happened, and that's kind of a fraction as to what's happened. I've done so much in the past 5 years, it's kind of hard to absorb it because it just keeps going back to back to back to back. You know, I go, wow, I don't even, you know, 5-6 weeks ago I was driving from Veracruz to Mexico City, ending this 18,000 kilometer drive that I did with Porsche. But I've done so much in between then that it's not that I forgot about it, but it's hard to absorb these things. It's almost like, you know, there's so much going on, but I'm on this roll now where I don't want it to stop. It's the beginning of the next chapter. You just keep going with the flow, and that's what life's about, making the most out of every moment. So I think that's also the connectability and relatability of just make the most out of every moment.
I want to get back to your story in a minute, but I've got some personal questions to ask you, because I dabbled with an obsession with Porsche and got it horribly wrong, and I'll tell you my story. I didn't really get into Porsches till I was in my 40s. And so I'm driving home from work one day and I see a Cayman S for sale in a car dealership. So I went in and he didn't want that much for it. He wanted 16,000 for it. I think it was an 05, might have been a late 04. So I bought this car and it starts using a lot of oil. Well, it turns out it has this bore scoring issue, which I don't know whether you're familiar with the water-cooled Porsches. Anyway, so it needed an engine rebuild. And so the guy gave me my money back and my Mazda MX-5, or Miata, as you call them.
How long had you on the car before he gave you your money back?
2 months.
Okay.
Not long. So he gave me my money back, and I thought, that's it. I'll just keep looking around. And then one day, I'm at Porsche Craft in Mill Hill. I don't know if you know those guys. They sell used Porsches. And I'm just walking around, just because I like them. And a guy says to me, he said, what are you thinking of? I said, oh, I had a Cayman S and had a bad experience. I'm thinking, I need to get a 911. So I said, but I had this bore scoring thing, and it terrifies me. And he said, well, why don't you get a rebuild? One that's been that's had the scoring and been rebuilt. He said, we've just got one just come in. It's just come in and hasn't even been looked at. In fact, the engine's out of it. It's being rebuilt right now. He said, you know, if you'll So we talked, and I went back, and I got my wife to look at it and whatever. And it was a C4S. It was an 05 Carrera 4S. So nice 3.8, plenty of juice. So four-wheel drive, you know. Thought, what can go wrong? It's a rebuilt one. So I got it, and it was great, but it started costing me money because all of a sudden the catalytic converters needed changing because it had about 95,000 miles on it.
The slippery slope.
Yeah. So it had 95,000 miles on it, so the catalytic converters had got clogged up from all the oil going through it because it had the bore scoring, but I didn't know, and it's now out of the three-month warranty that I'd got from the dealer, all the rest of it, so I had new exhaust system put on it, cost me about 1,200 quid. Something else, things just kept going wrong with it, and it was starting to cost me close to £1,000 a month just to keep the thing on the road. And then I get a job at BBC Radio Merseyside, which means I'm driving up, I'm doing like 400-mile round trip every Sunday, and they're not really that fuel efficient, the 3.8. And I ended up selling it, and now I've got a Lexus hybrid, which is just it's a nice car, but an unfortunate story.
Yeah.
What should I have done, or is there nothing I could have done to make that right? Should I have kept the Cayman S? Should I have?
It's a tough call. I mean, I've never owned, the newest Porsche I own is my 04.
It was a 997, by the way.
The newest Porsche I own is my 996 04 GT3.
Okay.
My experience with Porsche was complete opposite of that.
Yeah.
Because my collection mostly is 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
The new goal with me and Porsche is one everything Porsche has ever made in a sports car. You know, when people think of Porsche, they think of the 911. We know Porsche is celebrating.
And the air-cooled 911.
Air-cooled, yeah. You know, but Porsche is celebrating its 70th anniversary this year. June 8th, 1948 was the first licensed, registered Porsche Command Coupe made in Austria, actually. So the answer to your story, there is no real answer. I guess it's an unfortunate experience that you had, which is a common problem, but you seem to have, you know, doubled down and struck unlucky twice. I mean, my Porsche story is completely opposite because most of my cars, and I've owned a lot of them, are all from the 60s and 70s.
And you bought them before the prices have gone crazy now for those.
That's what I bought in 1992.
You didn't pay big money, the silly money.
I never paid big money for anything, even the current ones. I mean, I literally just bought, it's a funny story, back to my goal. You know, I've owned over 60 911s. I own one water-cooled 911. So they're all air-cooled. But to me, Porsche is all about variety. So the real goal is one of everything. So I'm talking front engine, mid engine, rear engine, air and water cooled. Right. So 4 or 5 years ago, I started collecting 924s, one of the unloved cars.
Yeah.
End up with a few 924 turbos, and I get a 928. So the goal is 924, 928, 944, 968, 914, which is mid engine air cooled, mm-hmm. Cayman, mm-hmm. mid engine water cooled, and then one of every generation of 911. Currently, I'm up to 996. But what I'm going to tell you right now is 3 weeks ago I just bought a 1987 944S non-turbo.
Front engine water cool.
Yeah, because it's on the list of cars I need. I've got the 1980 924, I've got the first year 78 928 Euro 5-speed. So I like to start in the beginning, even though obviously the 87 944 is not the first year of that. But my buddies at Sharkwood call me up and they go, hey, you're looking for 944. I go, yeah, it's on the list. They go, we found one. I go, first question, does it run? Yeah, it runs. Second question, what does it need? Not much, wheel bearing. Third question, how much is it?
$3,500.
$3,500.
Right.
I go, will it make it from San Jose to LA? He goes, yeah, I think so. I go, okay, I'll buy it, no problem. So I buy the car, I haven't even seen it. It's based on like 5 photos. I haven't picked it up yet. Hannah says to me, how many miles are on it? I go, I don't know, I didn't even ask him. To me, mileage is irrelevant. It either drives or it doesn't, right? You know, it's like back to the guy showing me the 500 mile car. That's the car that, you know, everything's wrong with it. It's only got 500 miles on it. All the hoses and seals are all cracked and all that stuff. It's better to have a car with miles that has been maintained. So your story is kind of unfortunate that you were unlucky twice.
But I got in at the wrong end. I should have gone in at the lower price then. I should have bought one of the unloved ones and just loved it.
People ask me this question all the time. They go, you know, I love what you do. I can't afford a 911, or I'm looking to get my first Porsche. What do you advise? I go, well, there's a Porsche for every budget. This is all based in America, but you got 5 to 10 grand, go buy a Boxster.
Yeah.
Best bang for the buck.
Yeah.
So when I started buying my cars, I was buying stuff that I liked personally, not stuff that was necessarily trendy at the time, expensive at the time. I always say, what's great about Porsche is you see a lot of high mileage Porsches compared to Lamborghini and Ferrari and other exotics.
Oh, they're everyday.
You don't see, it's a everyday practical everyman supercar in a sense. You know, you can't say that about a Ferrari and a McLaren and a Lamborghini. They're not as affordable. People don't drive them on a daily basis. So I started buying short wheelbase cars 10 years ago. At one point, I literally had five of the first 1,000 911s ever made, but I wasn't spending much money on them. I had five 67 S's. One time I had seven 3-liter turbos. I'm down to five. But I was buying them when they were literally 10% of what they're worth today. Mm. So I've never spent much money on anything.
And you didn't buy them as an investment. You bought them because you loved them.
I bought them because I loved them. I mean, I fell in love with Porsche 40 years ago through the turbo. But I didn't buy my first turbo till probably 5 years ago. But believe it or not, in the States 5 years ago, nobody cared about 3-liter turbos. It wasn't a trendy car. And so I owned seven of them. I'm down to five. But I picked them up because they were affordable. Now they're probably worth 10 times what I paid for them.
Yeah.
But I didn't buy them because, hey, this is an undervalued car that's going to go up 10 times.
Yeah.
I bought them because, hey, that's the dream car I fell in love with Porsche for.
Yeah.
When I was buying short wheelbase cars, it's because I like the purity of it, the simplicity of it. You know, for me, Porsche, when it comes to drives, it's all the same. It doesn't matter whether it's the 924, the 914, or the GT3. They all, in some way, take the five senses. Look good, smell good, sound good, feel good, taste good type of thing. It doesn't matter whether it's a 5 grand 914 or, you know, an early short wheelbase car that's worth a lot more money. In their own way, they both offer a rewarding driving experience. And I talk all the time about it. It's the journey. People go, well, what car do you drive? I go, well, it depends where I'm going and how I want to get there and how I want to experience that journey. If I want to go like balls out, pedal to the metal, it's a front row in the garage, sport purpose, streetable track cars. But that's everything from my 65 sport purpose, what I call my Vic Elford Monte Carlo rally inspired car, or my 67S, which is like an R inspired car, lightweight, you know, 200 horsepower in a car that weighs a little over 2,000 pounds, all the way up through 277, my favorite car, and then up to the GT3. Those are the streetable track cars. But if I want to step back in time 50 years, I can't do it in the GT3, but I get in my Irish Green 66 911. That is the closest thing I can do to stepping back in time 50 years. Let me tell you, 100 miles an hour in that car feels kind of scary because you're connected to it. It moves around. It's moving all over the road. It's on skinny 5.5-inch wheels. You know, it's noisy. You smell it. It's analog. You know, it's that intoxicating Porsche smell of oil, sweat, gas. You know, you don't get that in the new cars. In the new cars, you've got to be doing 150 miles an hour to feel fast. You know, and it's so insulated that you're disconnected from it. So it's all about the journey and how you want to experience it. No two cars ever drive the same. So that's why I own more than one. So I'm a goal-oriented collector. Next on the list is a 968. Ironically, I'm hoping to look at a 968 here in London. Well, here in England, the guy's hoping to bring it to the Ace Cafe on Saturday. It's a 968 Club Sport, right-hand drive. Porsche made like 115 of them. Now, I'm not looking for a right-hand drive car, but that's a pretty rare car. Price seems to be affordable for what it is. So things come to me, you know?
Yeah.
I would say 80% of the cars I own have never been advertised. It's word of mouth. You put it out there. I'm looking for... You know, now it helps. I'll put something on Instagram. It's like, you know, recently I posted, I bought the 944. And I said, next on the list is a 968. So then I saw the guy start emailing me, hey, I've got a 968 I'm thinking of selling. And it's always the same thing. It starts out with an email, someone's thinking of selling it. And it'll go one of two ways. I'll either buy it or I won't. But it's this emotional roller coaster ride sometimes of you just let it play out because it's an emotional thing for me and the seller. The seller's thinking of selling it, and then all of a sudden, when someone's really interested, maybe he's not ready to let it go. So sometimes these deals take less than impatience. I often jokingly refer to it as like, you know, going on your first date with a, you know, your future girlfriend. You don't quite know how far you're going to get, so you don't want your hand slapped, so you just let it evolve. You don't necessarily ask too many questions when it comes to Porsche. You let people tell you the story. And I've acquired a lot of cars like that. So I found my 64 911. Porsche only made 232 of those cars. There's like 70 documented worldwide. Of that 70 documented worldwide,
what's still running?
Still there.
Not even
crash parted, right. Wrecked, became race cars.
Yeah.
There's a registry because that's the beginning of everything 911, right? 55 years later, it's still in production. Porsche's made a million of them. But without the 64, those 232 cars, the 911 may never have evolved. Because let's not forget those 356 purists, they hated the 9/11 when it came out.
Did they?
They weren't fans of it. So, my 64 911, it's one of three dozen with the original motor. It was never advertised for sale. But this is great. It's a great Porsche story. I bought it from a guy who was the third owner. He'd owned it since the 70s. It had gone off the road in 79 for a restoration that never happened, and that kind of saved the life of the car from being, you know, a race car or wide-bodied slant-nose conversion in the 80s. But this guy I bought the car from, him and I became friends. He visited me in LA. I loaned him my Iris Green 66. He hadn't driven a Porsche in almost 40 years. I loaned him my car instead of a rental car when he came to LA for the weekend. All of a sudden, he's now looking to get back into the Porsche world. So I often talk about Porsche as a language. I say it all the time. Doesn't matter whether it's be English, German, or Japanese. We can all relate to the car. And that's what I call OPP, other people's Porsches. I've been fortunate enough to drive a lot of exotic Porsches that I could never afford to own. 959s, Carrera GTs, 918s. But that's the great thing about Porsche people, is they like to share the stories, and a lot of them like to share the experience of, hey, you want to drive my Carrera GT? Well, sure, I want to drive the Carrera GT. Who wouldn't, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that happens with other marks the way it happens with Porsche. I don't think it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you've more than answered my question, because when I went...
Remember what your question was.
Well, the question, my question, I was trying to get...
was about you and your two
Yeah,
your
and,
two
and Porsche. What I did wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you did it. It was unfortunate.
I think it's more of a metaphor, maybe, for your life. It's about passion. Because, you know, when I read your story about when you're on Venice Beach and you've got the market stall and what became Serious Clothing, you didn't go, I'm going to form this huge clothing company. You just went with your passion. You went with what was working, and you looked around and what felt good, and
it evolved.
And it just got, and so you ended up naturally putting more and more of yourself into it, which I think you've done with the cars too.
Same thing. It's that common thread. You know, there's a Serious tattoo.
Yeah.
So I spoke earlier on about there's a common thread that weaves the fabric of my story together, and it's passion and doing things that I love to do. I had no education in clothing design. I didn't go get a fashion degree. I don't think you need one. I mean, when Serious Clothing was successful and we were outfitting everyone from Alice Cooper to Madonna, and all, I met all my rock and roll idols through that. You know, I met Lemmy and Van Halen, and these were people that
I met. You went on tour with Alice Cooper.
I went on tour with Alice Cooper. We did wardrobe for Alice Cooper. I have one of Alice Cooper's leather jackets that he signed that he wore in the 70s that he gave me 20 years ago. So that happened because he, you know, he liked the clothing. We ended up making clothing for him. It was as simple as that. But when Serious Clothing was very popular, we'd often have people come up to us and ask advice, and it would kind of fall into a few categories. But the most interesting one was, it'd be like a mum come to us at a trade show. She had a store, and she says, you know, my daughter wants to get into fashion. She's thinking of going to FITM or Otis or this school of design. What do you think she should do? I said, well, you can go to school to learn the craft of business and maybe pattern making, but you can't learn the craft of ideas. You can't be taught an idea at school. You can be shown how fashion has evolved and fashion goes around in full circle, but they're not going to teach you an idea, because that comes from up here and comes from your heart, really, is where it comes from, and your own individual style and ultimately what makes you happy. You can't be taught that, I don't think. It evolves. So I describe myself as street smart back to leaving school at 15. I'm not preaching go leave school at 15, but that's my story. My sister, on the other hand, ended up with like 13 O-levels and 3 A-levels and a degree. She's book smart. That was the route she went. There's no right and wrong. You know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs, though, are more the street smart, the adaptive swimmer mentality. And that, for me, goes back to going to America when I was 19, of sink or swim. I'm either going to fail or succeed. But I think a lot of it also was that British bulldog spirit, and it wasn't always easy, and it took a long time to get there. But ultimately, it was always done my way. It wasn't like there were partners involved. You know, we didn't have investors involved that we had to answer to. We just did what we personally liked to wear, what made us happy. It wasn't like, okay, craft curated artisanal beer is trendy, so let's go make that, right? People have been brewing beer for 1,000 years. What's really changed there? You know, you do what you love, right? And I don't think that can be taught. It can be copied and emulated, but then you're following that trend, right? I always did what made me happy, and it was successful with the clothing because we created our own trend. It when we bought that building in downtown LA 18 years ago, people literally thought we're crazy. Why are you doing that? It's kind of a no-go zone. A little bit like Shoreditch might have been 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Who cared about that?
Yeah.
But yet now, different story. But for me, it didn't matter what other people thought. It was like, oh, you know, we'd rented this loft and we'd rented this warehouse.
So it wasn't this vision that if we buy this, this area is going to come up and all. It was just not, like, I really like it.
Not smart enough to have thought that way. Not smart enough. It was like, we were smart enough to know we're renting a 3,500 square foot loft and we're renting a 5,600 square foot warehouse to run the clothing company out of. And we know we're paying two people's mortgages and we know we're successful enough to, we could actually own our own building for not much more than we're paying to rent two buildings. But we didn't realize the neighborhood was going to become what it is. You know, it's becoming the Shoreditch or the Soho or the Williamsburg or the New Venice Beach. You know, I like projects. I've always liked projects. I've liked style, art, architecture, fashion, automotive. And what better way to express it than having your own building and doing it exactly how you want it to be done? Right? That's freedom right there. Back to doing whatever you want to do. Why not do it all under one roof? And then took that leap of faith and accidentally fell into the film location business. That wasn't planned. Even though I'd lived in downtown LA since 94, we didn't buy that building until 2000. So even though we'd seen all these iconic blockbuster films, Batman, Terminator, Gone in 60 Seconds, and numerous music videos shot in the neighborhood where I still live 25 years later, because we didn't own property, it didn't occur to us, oh, you can actually make money renting something out. That happened organically, accidentally. There was an article in the LA Times about loft gentrification in 2001, right after 9/11. At that time, we'd only lived in the building 6 months. We bought the building in 2000, spent a year building it out, and moved in like April or May of 2001. Well, 17 years later, we're still filming, and that's the day job. That's essentially pretty much what pays the bills, allows me to have more Porsches than I ever thought I would own, allowed us to close down the clothing company when we were no longer passionate about it, and that kind of supports my journey of this, what I like to call nomadic lone wolf gypsy going all over the world. These were all little steps that weren't planned. One thing led to another. Clothing company became successful, bought a building, got into film.
But each with its own passion for that project at the time.
Back to that common thread, yeah.
Not looking at the next thing, just making the best of
it. I never looked that far forward. I remember at school, you know, the career advisor, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I don't know where I'm going to be in 5 years from now. Hopefully healthy, enjoying life and traveling around and doing something creative that's enjoyable. But I never thought that far forward. So this is not necessarily a teachable thing, but I think there's an inspiration element that sometimes you don't need that safety net and that plan. You just need to be open to opportunity. You're going to come to the fork in the road. You're going to be able to go left, right, or straight ahead. You're not going backwards, right? But maybe you can go left, right, or straight ahead. It's just a matter of which one makes sense at that time. That's how my life has been. Some people really like structure and they know where they're going to be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. My accountant's like that. He goes, you're a risk taker, but it's kind of worked out pretty good for you. I say, well, that worked out for me, and you're a successful accountant and you're structured, and that worked out for you. So you just adapt, I guess.
Well, continued success, Magnus. We've been chatting now for just over an hour, and I wanted to keep this to an hour, so I'm going to wrap this up. You can probably see I've printed out 3 pages of questions.
How far did you get down the first
question
page?
Number four.
How many questions are on those 3 pages?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I didn't number them, but I didn't turn from the first page.
So there's probably 45 questions.
45 there. Questions. We got the first four.
Well,
that's what we got.
We got an hour of conversation.
We really did, though. Yeah. It's been terrific meeting you. Your story has been an inspiration to me. I read the book, but Urban Outlaw originally. You might not know the answer to this one, but as a final question, what's next for Magnus Walker?
Well, make the most out of every moment, travel, enjoy life, and things come in cycles. You know, I talk about cycles, even though you and I haven't spoke about it yet. There's always like an 8 to 10 year cycle. I talk about Urban Outlaw came out 5 years ago. It opened several doors, so maybe I'm halfway through that 10 year cycle. So as long as it's interesting and exciting, I think what's next is travel. I think there's going to be some cool stuff coming up that I'm working on. I've been fortunate enough to do some really cool stuff with some cool people like Porsche, and Hot Wheels for one is a collaboration that I'm super proud of. Hot Wheels, if you don't know, the celebrating their 50th anniversary. I have my own line of Hot Wheels little toy model cars. You know, ironically, I talk about that dream ride and how dreams started at an early age. My dream started at 10 when it came to cars and Porsche. And there's my Hot Wheels. It's literally been around the world. I've done 15 cars with Hot Wheels, but this is my own car, my favorite car, my 71 911T, the car known as 277. So Hot Wheels released this car. They actually made, I just found out, I had a meeting with them in LA on Monday. They actually made 500,000 of these. They're all gone, they're sold out, but we're reissuing a different colorway. But this is, for me, there's nothing cooler than having my own car immortalized in a 1/43rd scale.
Yeah.
And everyone has a Hot Wheels story. Here in England, it's probably Matchbox or Corgi.
We had Hot Wheels too, though, but yeah.
So you can relate to, well, this one's been in my pocket, and wherever I go, it goes with me. It's like Waldo or the gnome that goes around the world. So
it's the one with the highest mileage in your whole collection, then.
It is. And you can see how even the Hot Wheels toy has got patina, you know, half
yeah.
of it. The logos and numbers are scratched off it. But there's something really, for me, emotional about having that, and that's why it travels with me. So, long answer to the question, what's next? I don't know, but I think it's going to be great.
Magnus Walker, continued success.
Hey, great love and call, and appreciate all the support, and it's been great hanging out with you here on Shoreditch High Street, right around the corner from Bike Shed Motorcycle Club and the Ace Cafe, or Ace Hotel, I should say. So, cheers.
Cheers.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks to Magnus Walker. Guests I've got coming up on the show, the singer Kim Wilde and the composer and legend from War of the Worlds, Jeff Wayne. It's all happening on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. You want to hear more Mac Nuggets? Check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.